You're listening to Trope or Not to Trope, where your hosts, Kelly,
Kristen,
and Ray.
Welcome back to another episode from our archetype series. An archetype in storytelling is a character or idea with a set of patterns developed across time and which appears over and over in narrative. We've covered several archetypes, from the hero to the threshold guardian. If you missed any of them, feel free to check out those episodes before continuing with this one. Though it isn't necessary, we at times reference other archetypes already discussed. Today, we'll be talking about shapeshifters. Now, I know it sounds like we're talking about the superpower shapeshifting, and of course, this type of character can possess these powers, and we will be talking about that. But I wanted to touch on what the archetype means in story. A shapeshifter as an archetype is a difficult one to define. I know, it makes a lot of sense, right? As mysterious and mutable as a manic pixie dream girl who can fall under this archetype, a shapeshifter is a character who shifts emotions and desires. The shapeshifter is difficult for the hero to peg down, as the protagonist is constantly feeling like the shapeshifter keeps surprising them. The shapeshifter is supposed to confuse the hero, make them consider what's real and what isn't. They don't need to have nefarious plans for the hero, they just need to keep the hero guessing, since their whole point is to add confusion and mystery to introduce the concept of change. Just like the mentor or the threshold guardian, a character can fill one archetype, but then change to become a shapeshifter later on. In fact, this archetype can be found in a variety of characters: a love interest, an ally, a villain's lackey, or any other character or archetype they wish to also fill. Archetypes exist in relation to the hero, but when we're talking about specific instances of the shapeshifter, a hero can shift for the audience to increase drama. Now, this archetype is based on Carl Jung's concept of the anima animus, which is that we each hold and often suppress the qualities of the opposite gender within us. According to Jung, the acceptance of these hidden qualities helped with inner harmony. Historically, the shapeshifter has been used to reflect the hero's repression of their opposite gender characteristics to produce change or denial in the hero character. As this understanding of gender doesn't make much sense in modern society, instead, it may best be understood that the shapeshifter is often a character who exhibits the hero's suppressed ideals, doubts, and/or characteristics. Okay. Okay, sorry, that was long, but...
Because we all know it's impossible for men and women to understand each other.
Oh my gosh.
Obviously.
Yes, so you could see that. So, okay, I wanted to take a look at the shapeshifter through the lens of one of the most famous shapeshifters, Loki. So before I begin, as far as fictional shapeshifters go, do you two have a favorite shapeshifter? And here I'm thinking of Loki and all his mystical glory. So think of characters that can literally shapeshift. So bring me your werewolves, your mutants, your kitsune, etc.
I'm going to be so basic and say Reese.
Oh my god, I was going for the fence and Reese. Yep. Yep. Yeah. I'm like, I'm not proud of this answer, but like, oh my goodness. A strong runner-up was Jacob Black, just because he's so fun.
Oh my gosh!
We need to branch out, guys. We really need to branch out.
What about your third?
Okay, I will say the author Charles DeLint has really cool shapeshifters. Like, his characters usually have, like, both the animal and human in them at the same time, and, like, they just kind of tap into one or the other at will, rather than traditionally shifting, like, werewolves and whatnot. And, like, some people can see the characters as both forms at the same time, which is a really awesome way to do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, highly recommend all of his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What about you, Ray? Your third favorite?
I mean, Loki is a good one. Oh, there's also Mystique in X-Men. To bring in someone else who isn't, like, you know, a hot man. Like,
oh my gosh.
We have a hot woman.
He is also hot, though.
Okay. Yeah. Have you guys ever heard of the graphic novel Nimona?
I've heard of, have not read yet.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Cool, because it's, I think the TV show is coming soon, or I don't think it's already out. Anyway, there's a TV show, but it started with a book, obviously, and the Nimona character is Nimona, this girl, this little girl who can shapeshift, and she is hilarious. She's just so like fun, and she all she wants to do is basically become a villain.
Relatable.
Yeah, basically. I feel like Kristen, you should definitely read it, right? You should definitely read it. It's very fun, and it's just really cute in how it's done, and it's not your typical like, it's not your typical shapeshifter. I also really just like any kitsune is like a favorite of mine. I like that concept. There is this game called Genshin Impact, and there's a kitsune in that named Yai, and she is just so clever and funny, and she is both a shapeshifter, like literally, and then also like the archetype shapeshifter, and it's just, yeah, because you never know exactly which way she's going to lean. Like, is she going to give up important information that you didn't want her to, or is she actually like that could be on a grander plan of hers in helping you, but you can't tell. Like, she just kind of sits on the line, and I just like that concept. Yeah.
If I played video games, I might play Genshin. I mean, yes! Crunchyroll has advertised it enough at me. I'm like,
okay. It's free.
But, yeah. No, I need more kitsune in my life.
Yes. Yeah, she's really cute. And awesome and like clever and just one of the best characters. It's great. Okay, yeah. So not knowing whether a shapeshifter is what he or she seems, we obviously get tension and conflict. Can the hero even trust the shapeshifter? It's almost like a puzzle, sometimes even for the reader, viewer, or player. We see this in Loki, both the Marvel Loki and the mythical Loki. So let me just stop here. We're going to talk about Marvel Loki for simplicity's sake and the sake of reaching a broader audience, even though I very much love Myth Loki. But Loki not only changes his looks, but changes his personality to suit his needs. We as the audience come to understand and even expect that. He is the fundamental shapeshifter in both instances. He shows us not only his need to deceive, but the need to survive. So Loki is not a good guy, but he's interesting. And so the audience has come to expect deception and morally gray behavior. Loki is there to throw uncertainty at our heroes and the audience. In fact, some shapeshifters, such as Loki, where it is the character's choice to shift, are by their nature morally gray. A questionable moral compass allows for these characters to do what they must in order to achieve what they desire. It becomes especially useful if these characters live in a corrupt, dark world. But I found that at times morally gray characters and shapeshifters, by extension, are morally gray for the sake of being so. Before I ask kind of the question that most relates to that, I did kind of want to float out another question, which just came to me. How do you all feel about morally gray characters in general? Like, do you like them? Do you not like them? What are your thoughts?
I like them.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Did not expect.
Really? I enjoy good versus evil stories. I will go on that rant again if you want me to. But, like, morally gray characters are fun if they're written well and in the right story. Oh, yeah. You know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. I just know we've gone on rants on here before about how, like, everything is morally gray and, like, can we have, like, anything, yes, like, something different, like, from that?
Okay. Caveat to all of this. I don't much like morally gray stories. I love morally gray characters.
Okay. All right. What about you, Ray?
I'm here for it.
Yeah.
It's usually, it's a little more interesting because your character has more options. Usually they're not held back by morals, so there is more uncertainty with, like, okay, what's that person going to do? How far are they willing to go? Because you don't know as well. Like, there are lots of things that, like, most normal people would be like, I'm not gonna do that.
Yeah, I feel very similar, obviously very similar to you too. I love morally gray characters. I think it really does put a spin on, especially if the story is not morally gray in general, Like, if it is just kind of like you're going back to Kristen's point, like if it is just a story that is maybe has a moral to it, like loosely or something, or is not like a dark world per se, when you have a morally great character and you throw them into the mix, it's great because then you can kind of see the kind of like it almost, the morally great character almost takes that world and lets the reader, the viewer, whatever, see it in a different way, which I think is kind of cool.
Yes, that is always interesting.
Yes. Okay, so going back to my original, what I was going to ask you guys is, so like I said, at times morally gray characters are morally gray for the sake of being so. So how do you actually fix this?
Great real people. Always, always the answer. Like, so all people have their own moral code, right? They all have their own values that they live by. So even if a character is morally gray and their moral code doesn't line up with society's, like if they don't think that the same things are important, they still think that some things are important. And so like you as a writer should know what your character's moral code is, even if it's gray, you know? And like you have to make sure that every choice they make lines up with what they believe about the world.
I was actually looking at this idea like sort of inversely to that. Like, say you want to write a morally gray character, then like you have to put them in a world that makes sense, like for that. So it's more like if they're in a corrupt world, then they might be morally gray by necessity. Like, I would bring up how in Game of Thrones, like Ned Stark is not corrupt, and that's what leads to his downfall. Meanwhile, all the other characters that are like varying shades of morally gray, like, tend to fare a little bit better. So like, I see what you mean by like, I think some writers choosing to have morally gray characters as like a flavor that they like and not because it's what the story calls for, which I'm kind of okay with, so long as it tracks well enough with the story's reality. Like, you see how this idea becomes circular real quick, because if a character is morally gray and it makes sense, then it looks less like an aesthetic choice and more like what, like, I know it's been trendy to have morally gray characters recently, so you're going to have more instances of it being done poorly just because you have more instances of it overall.
Like, and I think the problem is when they're morally gray for the sake of being morally gray, you end up with a ton of back and forth in your story, and it just gets annoying, and it starts to not make sense because the character is making choices for the drama and not for whatever makes sense.
I think what both of you are saying, very interesting, because it, okay, so if you take a story and the story is told from usually, I mean, from like one perspective, or at least like whether it be a narrator is flavoring the world or the character and that their point of view is flavoring the world. But you usually get like, okay, your world is flavored by whatever the focus is and like how that focus wishes to tell the story. Perhaps, and how they see the world. So if you look at it from that perspective, it almost feels like you guys are saying like very similar things, like basically give your morally character a reason. But, and that reason is essentially like a very similar thing in that, okay, well, like the reason for this is for this character to be morally gray is because the world is morally gray and did some pretty crappy things to this character. And so like, cool, that makes sense. But if you have a morally gray character and you give, and let's say the world is like, fine, like somewhere just a normal world, and like the morally gray character is given reasons still, like awful background, whatever, their world would essentially be gray or like awful. So perspective.
I think what some people try to do is use their morally gray character like a wild card that they could use for like anything that they want to make happen. The problem with that is it doesn't it doesn't make sense. You're just like being like, oh, they're morally gray. This means they can do whatever. And it's sort of like even a morally gray person wouldn't do that because it does not benefit them in any way, shape, or form. Like,
yep. Oh God. It is not a good plot holes free card.
It's true. But it kind of reminds me of like in D&D there's like this running understanding that if you choose chaotic good, basically that means you can do whatever you want, and like that's not what chaotic good is. That's what people typically use it for. Mm-mm. It's like, yeah, just do whatever you want, morally gray character.
Yeah, honestly, I'm even fine if a morally gray character doesn't have a reason for being morally gray. Like, you make your own choices, you do you, as long as the choices all make sense for the one character, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so this also kind of brings up the question, how many times can a shapeshifter shift before it becomes unrealistic and makes the character feel like a story tool rather than a person?
Oh, I feel like Marvel definitely did this with Loki.
Oh, like, my gosh.
And basically all of your characters. I mean, that's if you're looking at multiple movies, though. Like, in a given Marvel movie, they tend to be more consistent with whatever their take is on a particular character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they do that with Loki all the time. It's like they can't decide if they want him to be, like, oh, a bad villain, or, like, just kind of, like, Thor's trickster brother. Like, you know? Like.
So, I will say, as long as the protagonist doesn't trust the shapeshifter, I don't really have a limit for how much they can shift. Like, they can go back and forth all they want. But when it comes to, like, the shapeshifter breaking the protagonist's trust, the answer is once. They can shift once.
Any
more than that, it just gets so annoying. Because there's, like, so much back and forth. And there aren't usually stakes when there's that much back and forth. And so, like, the more times it does it, like, the less interested I am in the story, because, like, the protagonist just, like, cries for a night and then moves on with her life and then trusts him again and then cries for a night and moves on with her life. And I'm like, okay, if you don't care, why should I care?
Yeah, don't keep making that same bad decision. Like, I know people do that in real life, but a story is supposed to be hopefully less annoying than real life.
Yeah, like, forward momentum. You can make different mistakes. Like, just don't make the same one.
I like that idea around it, but, like, just for, like, the shapeshifter shifting in general, I don't think it's number of times so much as number of inexplicable times. Like, if you're writing a good story, the shifts should ultimately make sense. So they can shift plenty of times, so long as we believe that's what that character would do. If a character shifts in a way that the audience doesn't understand, I think you can do that once, and provided everything else is working that far, the audience will keep watching, but they'll still be wondering, like, what happened there? So it's best if you can come back around and show why that shift happened. So like, you get one leap in logic, and it's on loan. Kind of. That's like if you're writing a good show. And like, that's like also more important the closer that character is to your main storyline. Like, because we care less about, like, you know, distant side characters. And like, I know there are plenty of shows that like get away with doing things for the drama. And you keep watching anyway because like you're more engaged by the other stuff that's going on. But like, for it to be, you know, a good story, things should make sense.
I will say, as a caveat to that, though, like, the purpose of the shapeshifter is to keep things not making total sense. So you have to walk that fine line of making it believable, even if it's not necessarily, like, even if it doesn't totally make sense. Like, it has to be believable.
Like, I think you can kind of get away with that. I think something that's also at play there is, like, if the story is good, it's like that character, this is about the hero's perspective, so that character does not make sense to the hero. I think it's like cool and bonus points if that character like actually makes sense, and maybe we just don't know about like all of their backstory, all of their context or whatever, and later that gets revealed and they ultimately do. makes sense. But, like, I think the main point with, like, them being a shapeshifter is, like, what defines them as an archetypal shapeshifter is that the hero does not understand them or has, like, a misled image of who that person is, like, who they think that person is, and later you find out that they're wrong. So it's not so much, like, the person appears to shift to the hero, but, like, it's not even necessarily that they're shifting. They're just going along, being themselves, and, like, the hero had, like, wrong ideas about them.
Yeah. That also depends on how close your narration is. Like, if you're looking through the hero's eyes, then the audience isn't going to understand the shifting if the protagonist doesn't. Mm-hmm. But if it's, like, if it's a further third narration or, like, a movie, then it's easier for the shifter to make sense and us to look at the protagonist like, oh, you're dumb.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I think that I was thinking of that I might want to add is going back to Kristen's point. Like, I know you had said that, okay, the shapeshifter shifting once will probably, well, I understand that you had a lot of caveats there, but but at the same time, like, I could see that, because if the shapeshifter only shifts once in the sense of not talking about the hero's perspective at all, just like plot reasons, for example, like, let's say the shapeshifter is an ally and then shapeshifts into, oh, I'm actually a villain, having them shift back and forth like that wouldn't make sense, or would seem like Kristen was saying, like, the hero is stupid. Like, what the heck? Mm-hmm. Don't trust this person. But just that impact of having that person change once is good enough, and then that person still fills the archetype's role that I could see, like, impact-wise in the narrative, it making sense. But I think, going back to everyone's point, it depends what you're trying to do.
Uh-huh. Yes. I don't think this is the instance that you meant with your example, Kristen, about how they get to shift once. But, like, there are totally stories where it's like you have someone who is a bad guy, basically. Like, they're working for the bad people. And they meet your hero or whatever, and they don't know that your shapeshifter is actually a bad guy, and they become friends, they become part of the party, whatever. And then there's a point in the story where, like, betrayal happens because the person was actually a bad guy. And so, like, you know, it's like this big deal, and that's like your big shift for the hero from the hero's perspective. But, like, I also like it when, like, you, like, it built throughout the story, you also find out that, like, the shifter actually, like, came around to see, like, the hero's side and is actually ultimately on the hero's side. So it looks from the hero's perspective, like, they're shifting back and forth, when really, like, what happened is they were a bad guy, but then they realized that, like, the hero's right, and, like, ultimately in the end helps them, saves them. That's, like, technically two shifts from the hero's perspective. But, like, I don't think that's the instance you were talking about.
No, you can definitely, like, do that story. And you can even do more shifts within that story if, like, the big bad has the little bad's girlfriend tied up somewhere or something. So they, like, help the bad guy, and then they help the hero, and then they help the bad guy and try and save their girlfriend, but then they help the hero because they grow feelings and, like, so forth.
Yeah, like, that's fair.
That is a story that you can do, and, like, a very classic use of the shapeshifter. But if we're just talking about, like, a normal story, then
going back and
forth gets annoying. Uh-huh.
Normal people don't have big bads in their life, at least not.
Like, no, but thinking about the stories that do it badly, where I know what you mean, Kristen, where it's just like this character keeps shifting back and forth, and it's obvious as, like, a reader or a watcher, like, I know what's happening. Why is the hero acting so stupid?
Ooh, you know what would be an interesting shapeshifter is, like, an office Karen. So, oh like, my gosh. Just keeps going back and forth of, like, trying to climb the social ladder, but also, like, kind of being friends with your protagonist, and, like, that can work as a shapeshifter.
Yeah. Office carried.
Yeah, just living that psychophant lifestyle. Like, gotta change who you are to appeal to whoever, like, whoever's your next rung on the ladder.
Okay, so as we were talking about, you can see that the shapeshifter is an archetype that can be worn by multiple characters in a story, even apparently, if you so choose, an office Karen. Now, it can also, as mentioned earlier, kind of our archetype can be our beloved hero. So think, for instance, of a hero who has fooled even the audience in who they are by how they're presented. Is there a difference functionally between a hero who fits the shapeshifter archetype? So the hero who is fooling the audience versus another character filling the shapeshifter archetype.
Okay, so I have feelings about this. If the hero is the shapeshifter, then the story is inevitably going to be about misdirection. Like, that's the story you're writing, which is a cool story, and I like it, but there's, like, not a ton of wiggle room in it. So if you commit to that, that is the story that you are writing. Like, I very much hate the trope of unreliable narrators, and I think we're going to do an episode on that in the future, so I will spare you all of the details for now. But, like, basically, your reader is primed to trust your protagonist and believe everything they say. So, like, there's a really fine line between writing an unreliable narrator and just being a bad writer. And if you don't pull off the unreliable narrator perfectly, you just come across as a bad writer.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, doing this on a large scale is very difficult to pull. Like, everything has to make sense. So it's like all of their actions have to make sense leading up to, and then you realize, big plot twist, basically. Like, they're actually like this. Like, like, I think a more minor version of this happens frequently with, like, mastermind characters. Like, this is Sherlock knowing more than you think he knows, or this is, like, a thief or a con man pulling off a job and the plan seems to be going wrong, but according to plan all along. Like, those aren't that much of a shift because the smart character turning out to be even more smart than we originally thought isn't that much of a leap. Like, that's not that much of a shift.
Yeah, personally, I just, like, really hate stories where everything is not as it seems, because I'm usually just left at the end with a feeling that I wasted time investing myself and remembering story details when I didn't have to.
Yeah, like, stories that completely tear down their whole world.
Right? It's so annoying. Yeah. And, like, I have more space for this in movies because there are more tricks to clue the audience into the fact that everything is not as it seems. So you have, like, the music and the lighting and all of that. But, like, in books, all you have is the protagonist's point of view, and it gets really annoying.
But if you can pull it off, the surprise factor there is fantastic. I know you said that you don't like that, but it, for me, it almost feels like a magic show. Like, I want you to fool me, but I need you to do it correctly. And if you don't do it correctly, then it annoys me.
Yeah. I mean, this is why, like, this isn't, I don't think this is quite a shapeshifter character, but this is why the big twist in The Sixth Sense is such a big deal. Because they pulled it off. The twist totally fits. And I haven't met anyone that, like, saw it coming, you know? Because, like, they do give you, like, all of the information and all of the details line up. And then at the end, it's still this, like, big surprise.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever read a book that I thought did it well.
Like, makes sense.
Actually, I don't know if that's true. Like, I've read books that, like, did what they set out to do, but I did not like them.
I've read books that have done it poorly. Like, I've read books where you can tell that they are intentionally, like, keeping information from the reader, like, but, like, it's so obvious that you can just kind of fill in, like, you know something is going on there, but they're pretending it isn't. And it's like, really? Come on.
How do you two feel about Fight Club?
It's been so long since I've seen that, and I've never actually read it.
Oh, sorry. The book is actually pretty good.
I've seen the movie. It was, there's a lot of aspects about it I appreciate. Right now I'm trying to think if the thing works overall. Like, there were parts of it that, like, there are parts of it that feel weird because, like, you literally see the scene where he's, like, fighting with Brad Pitt, and then later you're supposed to believe that he was just punching himself alone in a parking lot. Like, and that that feels a little bit weird, like...
or like, when he... Sorry, spoilers. Mm-hmm. But, like, he at the end, he, like, shoots himself in the head, and, like, we're supposed to believe, like, oh, he somehow miraculously survives, but he kills that side of his psyche. Like, that's...
Yeah, because that makes the fact that they show it with two people makes it difficult to parse, like, which things is he actually doing, like, which self is actually the real self in a given instance, and all the actions that are directed toward the other self, is he doing those to himself, or, like, just thinking of doing that to, like it's
I have more space for that because I feel like the movie wasn't trying to make perfect sense. It was trying to do other things. Yeah. And so I'm like, it's a little weird and it's a little wonky logic, but, like, sure, it accomplished what it was trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I think it portrayed the things that it was trying to, which is more important, basically. Yeah. Like, I have space for it because, like, it is a hallucination kind of thing, so you can point to it, be like, logistically this, or practically this, doesn't make sense, and it's like, yeah, of course it doesn't, it's like, it's a hallucination, like but it does make it difficult to, like, interpret, because you are frequently seeing the hallucination, so
yeah,
like, which things are real and which aren't.
It's definitely harder to pull off, like we've all been saying, but, like, extremely hard. You have to be good. But again, going back to the, at least for me, when it's done correctly, I actually like the, I like that part of, like, if it's done in such a way where there's enough lamp shading beforehand and I can, like, reread it and then see all those clues line up. I don't know. I kind of like that. It's, I don't know. Yeah.
I tend to get annoyed when I see it coming, and then I also get annoyed when I don't see it coming.
So
there's no way to win.
Yeah.
I don't like predicting stories. Like, I actively try not to predict stories when I'm reading them, because then... like, if I'm right, it annoys me, and if I'm wrong, it annoys me, so I'm just, like, here for the ride.
So how do you just shut that off? You just do it?
At years of practice, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't speculate about the ending, usually. And so, like, I think that's why this, like, this trope annoys me. Specifically, like, the trope of the hero annoys me because I don't like guessing at the ending, and that trope is made for guessing at the ending.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Oh, that's interesting, though, because I feel like, so I have this obsession with the perfect ending, which is 90% of the time the ending of a book or, like, a TV show or whatnot does not satisfy me. And it, I just have to turn off the side of my brain that is like, but it could be so much better.
I sometimes find it to be a good exercise. Like, if I find an ending that I really don't like, it's a pretty good exercise to basically write fan fiction, like, write your alternative ending. And, like, sometimes you learn things. Like, sometimes I've tried to do that before and I've realized, oh, like, the author did actually pick one of, like, the best endings, because a lot of other ways to, like, push this, like, don't actually make it more satisfying. It just doesn't, it's just a story that doesn't have a satisfying ending.
Which, like, yes, I have found that too. And it's, and I, like, sometimes I do think about that. And I think about the fact that, like, I will try to pinpoint when, like, in the story, and this, I mean, so impossible to, like, figure out, I guess, but, like, when in the story, around when it got to a point where it's like, okay, this is how we got that ending, and this is why it's, like, the perfect quote unquote ending for the series, but it still makes me upset because sometimes it just doesn't, I don't know. Maybe it's because I just want, like, a, it's not even like a happily ever after or like a perfect ribbon on like a, maybe it isn't like a perfect ribbon on a present, but it has to match the tone, which mm-hmm. doesn't always happen, or it has to match kind of like the beginning, or there has to be something mm-hmm. that makes sense for the vibe. Maybe it's the vibe. And a lot of times, like, especially if I'm reading a book, a lot of my books will end on a happy note. And sometimes that makes sense. And other times I'm like, this does not make sense for this world.
Interesting. Did you read Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng?
No, not yet.
I have not either.
Okay. I am curious what you would think of the ending of that. Because, like,
oh,
I understand exactly why it ends the way it does, but I did not like it.
Oh, okay. All right. To read list. Okay. So kind of moving right along. Sometimes the love interest can fall into the shapeshifter archetype. This is because a hero may have a flawed concept of their love interest. So instead of seeing them for who they are, the hero instead projects a perfect concept onto their love interest. Because this concept is flawed, the hero begins to see a change in this unfortunate character. Now, this character only functions as the shapeshifter not because they're trying to deceive necessarily, but because it's the hero's story and we're shattering the hero's perspective. This is why shapeshifters are often manic pixie dream girls or boys, femme fatales or homme fatales, and the romance genre's main love interests, who happen to not be as perfect or put together as the hero, you know, first thought. So I wanted to ask, in which way do you all feel is the best use of the shapeshifter archetype, when the character is actively aware they're shapeshifting or when it's a misunderstanding?
The way you phrase that. I always hate misunderstanding tropes, just as a rule. Like, I think there is value in a shapeshifter existing to make the protagonist think and reassess their life and all of that. But, like, for the love of God, do not do it through making the protagonist jump to dumb conclusions for his drama. Don't do it.
I think either can work well. This isn't the same thing. Like, either of these can be frustrating depending on how actively dumb the hero is.
Yes.
Like, if the hero feels unnecessarily stupid, like the writer has their thumb on the scale, making the hero miss blatant signs that this person is not what they think, like, that frustrates me. So if a shapeshifter character is actively deceiving the hero and it all makes sense, I'm here for it. If a character accidentally misleads the hero, I'm here for it. Like, particularly in YA, where the hero tends to be a little naive, I definitely have space for that. But sometimes they can be a little too naive. And I think that's more often what makes, like, a good use of the trope or not, like, rather than whether the other character intended to deceive them or not, is like just how actively stupid is your hero.
Yes.
Oh no.
I will say shifters that know they're shifting are, like, obviously more interesting just from the get-go. Like,
yeah.
But they're also not often as complex of storytelling as a more symbolic shifter. So it depends on what kind of story you're trying to tell.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. And thinking about, like, for example, some literary fiction, where I feel like that's where we see a lot of the, you know, character is not aware they're shifting because it's all about the hero's perspective, because literary fiction is sometimes they try new exciting things and they write very pretty sentences, and, like, I get it. It's a really good use to, like, show character and, like, character studies and whatnot, and the value of perspective. I don't know. But but I will say, like, I think either of these could be done if done well, blah, blah, blah. But I really do love when the shapeshifter actually knows that they're shapeshifting and is just clever and cunning and, like, intriguing and complex and, like, mysterious and maybe a bad guy. And, you know. Of course. No. Or a pirate.
Yeah. Like, my favorite instance of it is basically the enemies to lovers kind of story, where, like, the love interest starts out intending to betray the hero, but ends up falling in love with them. Like, I don't know. We've talked about like Princess Diaries on here before. In the second movie, Chris Pine's character does pretty much that. Like at first he doesn't want Mia to be queen, so he's working with his uncle against her, but then he learns more about what kind of person she is and he actually wants her to be queen. And of course he's a shifter from Mia's perspective because they start out as like enemies, rivals, and then they get romantically interested, and then she thinks he's betrayed her, and then by the end everything gets resolved and they're romantic again, like, and it makes sense and it's just is a good time.
Yeah, although you can come at that from the other perspective too, because wouldn't Mr. Darcy also be a shifter but solely from Lily's perspective because she's like projecting onto him?
Yeah. And he's not intentionally. Yeah,
so both work. Just depends on what you're trying to do.
Yeah, and those characters aren't too dumb for me. Like, Lizzie's not too dumb. No. Mia's not too dumb. So, it's a good time.
Yeah, as long as they're intelligent, and it's more about, like, a different facet of their personality and flaws in that regard, then sure.
Ooh, yeah, because Chris Pine has, like, Mia's confidence that she can't quite find.
Ooh. It makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Those movies are just excellent. I hope they make a third.
They are, aren't they? Or I thought I saw something.
If there are rumors, I haven't heard anything like
official. Oh my gosh. Okay. Okay. So speaking of perception, I wanted to talk about shapeshifters and perception and bring it all back to Loki. Now, we haven't touched on the trickster archetype yet, which Loki can very much fill. But I briefly wanted to mention a difference between the two. Simply put, a trickster and shapeshifter often go hand in hand, as the two archetypes involve change. But for the most part, one big difference is perception. So when a shapeshifter is presenting themselves or is seen as something they are not, this archetype is usually playing with the hero or other character's perception. While a trickster wishes to upend the status quo for chaos or for humor, perception be changed or not, it doesn't really, that isn't as important. So we'll get back to tricksters in a future episode, of course, but all this to say that the shapeshifter's purpose is to play with perception. So because of that, this archetype can be seen across many stories. And I was wondering if you two had opinions on this archetype and how it's presented in various genres, kind of keeping that perception in mind or whatnot. Is there a difference between a shapeshifter in, say, a romance versus a shapeshifter in a fantasy?
Well, your fantasy stories are more likely to have literal shapeshifters.
Yes.
Paranormal romance fan.
Ooh.
Paranormal romance. Weirdly, those are probably not going to be your archetypal shifters. They're just going to be hot men who can turn into bears and wolves and dragons and whatever.
Dinosaurs.
Large dinosaurs.
You know.
Large cats.
Cat. Yeah, like, you know, you're not just like a cat that is abnormally large, but like, you know, a lion or
mountain lion,
a leopard, or like a panther. I don't know,
or a large house cat. That's fine too.
That's fine too. We don't discriminate.
Hey, so on the topic of this question, I want to talk about the trope "She's pretty, who knew." Because it's essentially someone else forcing the hero to shift and, like, changing their perception of themselves. And, of course, you know, changing the hot, hunky guy's perception because, whoa, she took off her glasses and now she's hot. Uh-huh. But, like, what do you think about that? Where, like, someone forces the hero to shift and change their own perception of themselves. Did that make sense?
Like, it's an interesting thing. I think it also happens in kind of the... It can happen in the other direction. This is, like, the instances where someone gets transformed into something ugly. Like, and that's, like, more literal. Like, I know the ones where it's, like, she's pretty, who knew, is, like, sometimes you don't quite buy it because it's, like, oh, goodness, she was so bad-looking before. Like...
She had glasses.
But, like, the ones that, like, it's... You have instances like Beauty and the Beast where, like, oh, the prince who is, like, a jerk gets transformed into a beast, and then he has to deal with that. Or you have things where it's, like, in Howl's Moving Castle, Sophie is, she gets cursed to be an old woman, basically. And so there's, like, those are interesting things. I'm trying to get at, like, why or, like, what's interesting about them. I suppose it's just a very, like, visual, clear way to show that the hero is seeing themselves in a new light. It's not just an internal change. They're literally responding to an external change.
Mm. It's also a forced call to action. Like, you can't refuse that call, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, no, you I'm cannot a frog deny. Now. I guess I have to, you know, do my thing as a frog.
I also feel like, at least in Sophie's case, like thinking about how who Sophie was before she changed into an old woman, weirdly enough, was just someone who didn't have the confidence or like didn't think that she would amount to much and didn't say very much, was meek and mild, and then was turned into an old lady. And it's like, oh, cool, I can say whatever I want. And it like almost frees her. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Something else that I think that particular change points out is like, Sophie, you're already living like you're like old and done with your life, like that sort of thing. Like, she didn't go anywhere, she didn't try anything. It's like, oh, it's like you're already done. It's like you skipped all of like the adventure bits and went straight to being an old person. So like, it's both like it's cool because it's like showing her sort of what she was already doing, and then it's cool that she uses it to basically go out and do the things that like she was afraid to do before.
It's also interesting because then thinking about Kristen, I know you haven't seen the movie just yet, but because it's a movie, just like the book. I mean, the book shows this as well, but the movie, since it's so it's shortened, it's like very much apparent. But you see Sophie, and again, like meek and mild, and immediately when she shifts into being an old woman, she starts like telling people what she thinks, and like she's like, oh, I'm old, so like you need to do this for me. And and so thinking back to your initial question, Kristen, where it's like, does this make sense of, all right, so you have like this makeover, and then maybe it gives the character confidence, or maybe it changes another character's perspective of them. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that like typically it's I think it does make sense. And I think like, it's definitely a different way of looking at things. But, and like Sophie's case, it's interesting because like, when you think old lady, you don't think like, oh, you know, Sophie was not bad looking or anything. She's a young lady, you know, Howell was like flirting with her. And so like, then she gets this makeover and it's actually like a positive thing. So that's kind of cool. Then thinking about the fact that sometimes with these makeovers, there is this underlying concept of, oh, not even a lesson, but kind of a lesson where it's like, okay, I'm going to try to feel this way. I have confidence, whatnot, or I'm acting like an awful person perhaps. And then near the end of the story, the character's like, wait, never mind. I learned something from this, but I want to go back to how I used to be and just kind of like shift again almost, but shift into a new version of themselves. I've seen stories like that before.
Like the shift is like the, if you have a story where a character gets transformed into something, like a very natural way for that story to go is they get transformed into something so that they can learn something. And then once they've learned it, they can change back. Like that's a natural sort of structure that fits that type of story.
Like the Beast.
And then you have Shrek that goes, no.
That goes, yeah. And there are exceptions. Back to like our question about genres, I don't know about differences in like the shapeshifters themselves, but like I think there are differences in like across stories, like how many shapeshifters and stuff that you have. Like horror and mystery are full of shapeshifters, especially if there's a bad guy at the end. Like that character is usually a shapeshifter since the hero doesn't know that they are the bad guy, like at the beginning. but like mm-hmm. almost every character in a horror story or a mystery is a shapeshifter, because there are betrayals, there are people with things to hide. You could argue that if they weren't all like shapeshifters, then you're leaving story opportunity on the table.
Yeah. Like,
something that is interesting about mystery is, even though all these characters are shifting for the audience, depending on how you play like your mastermind detective, the shifting characters may not actually be the shapeshifter archetype, because the detective might see right through their charade. Like Sherlock in particular, like the BBC version, does this constantly with minor characters. Like they encounter someone like who like has this particular story, and Sherlock like looks them up and down, notices a bunch of details about them, and knows like the real truth immediately. But like, he's still faced with shapeshifters when he has to deal with more important characters. Like, sometimes John surprises him, and there's definitely the episode where Moriarty first makes an appearance. Like, Sherlock did not connect those dots. Like,
yeah. Weirdly, like, I know the classic picture of this archetype is terrible, and like the gender thing is weird, but I do love the way that like classic film noir, like thriller, whatever movies treat this character, because it's just so like, yes, this character is shape shifting, but you still don't know how it's gonna end. There's something just fascinating about it that doesn't carry over as much into modern stories, because I think it's because, like, we know the tropes that the classic movies are trying to do, so it's easier to spot. And, like, nowadays, there are new ways to hide it, and so it's, you know, less interesting, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the film noir, like, they're heavy with, like this air of mystery kind of thing around so many characters. And it seems like, even if the character isn't... like, it's like they're painting the character like they're mysterious, even if that person wouldn't normally be that mysterious.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a cool vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you don't know if that character is necessarily going to, like, try to kill the hero, or, oh, actually, like, they weren't. It was just kind of what the hero was perceiving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like that film noir lens, like, makes everyone look like, oh, they could be a killer.
Yeah.
Yep.
It also is interesting. I know we mention heist every time, but that's fine. Thinking about heist and thinking about how there could be multiple shapeshifters within a heist, so you could have, like, the mastermind, you could have side characters that are all shifting for the audience or maybe for each other, and that's fine and good. But then you could also, sometimes in certain heists, there's like the new kid or like the new guy. And he also becomes the fall guy because the mastermind has figured out that he's actually working against them. And so there are like layers upon layers upon layers of all this shape shifting because the mastermind and the other characters are all shifting against this one character, and this one character is shifting against them or trying to, but also the audience. And it's just like this weird, very layered type shape-shifting.
Deception upon deception upon deception.
Yeah, which makes sense for what a heist is doing, what a mystery is doing, what a horror is doing. Like, a shapeshifter is all about change and all about kind of keeping the hero and or the audience guessing. And so that's what all of these things kind of do. Yeah. Essentially, I mean, any story does, but like these genres, subgenres especially.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think most other genres that are more like, what, like contemporary, mundane, don't usually have as many shifters. I think in just about every, like, romance story, though, the love interest is a shifter.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of how you have, like, tension and buildup is, like, they have to have some misconceptions about each other. At the very least, they go from seeing each other as, like, I don't know, like, because that's what we're describing when we say, like, friends to lovers or enemies to lovers is, like, there's literally a shift. They go from being one thing to the other.
Yeah. I feel like this archetype slash trope you could get really in the weeds with and just like go down the rabbit hole and be like, every character shifts all the time because people change.
Oh my gosh. People change and your understanding of them changes. And like, oh. Yeah, no. I'm trying to stick to like dramatic shifts. Right. Like, yeah, you are not who I thought you were.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so I guess this is a good time to ask, how does one write a shapeshifter well?
I stand by that the shapeshifter's motivation should make sense. Like, it annoys me when you can tell that the author is doing things purely to mess with the hero. So you have a shapeshifter that's doing all these things, and it makes me wonder why they're acting like that. And you find out, oh, no real reason. It's just for the drama. Like, sometimes in, like, enemies to lovers stories, the love interest will swing wildly between seeming to hate the main character and being in love with her. And, like, okay, like, Twilight did this pretty well, because Edward is a moody, dramatic, arrogant vampire, and his explanation of his actions toward Bella tracks. Like, it makes sense. After the fact, like, they explain all of it. But there are some books, that you have, like, all of the shifting and none of the reasoning. Like, there's a reason your hero is confused by this character, and it's because they don't make sense. Like,
right.
And it makes me very, very frustrated, because sitting here as the reader, I'm like, do I just not get it? Like, is there going to be a reveal at some point that's going to show how, like, oh, like, it's actually tracked, like, all along, or not? Like, and I just lose faith the farther it goes. So, yeah. So please make your shapeshifters make sense for my sanity, please.
I agree wholeheartedly. Also, like, know what you're trying to do with your story. And, like, you can write a shapeshifter for the sake of writing a shapeshifter, but after you have that first draft, you have to, like Ray said, go back and make sure it makes sense. Like, it's just, we've talked about the many different types of shapeshifters you can have in different stories, and so you have to make sure those two mesh really well.
Yeah.
Also, make sure that your shifters play off of your heroes. Because, like, Kelly, you had mentioned at the beginning, like, the shapeshifter is often, like, a portrayal of the hero's doubts or repressed characteristics or whatever. And so you're going to have a more hard-hitting story if the shifter is related to your hero in that way and makes them realize something about themselves or makes the audience realize something about the hero or so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think if you're going to do something like that, it also might benefit you to, because when you're coming up with a story, the story is going to be, obviously, I would hope, about the hero. And so, like, fleshing out the hero makes sense. But then also, if you are going to go that route and, like, think about, like, I love that concept of taking maybe, like, repressed characteristics or something, or characteristics that maybe the hero wants or is, like, kind of headed towards but isn't there yet. If you then take those traits and then start thinking about that character, but think about that character as an actual character instead of just, like, a reflection of, like, the hero that is not the hero. Wow. Yeah. And then also thinking about character art, like, if you are going to make them, I guess I'm thinking more of maybe, like, if it's a romance and this shapeshifter character is, like, essential to the story, think about that character's story arc and how that plays against the hero's character arc and how they clash and how you would play that up and how you would play up the, again, going back to the repressed characteristics of the hero and how that would make the hero feel if they see these characteristics. Does it make them cringe? Does it make them jealous, like, envious? Does it make them kind of upset and they don't really understand why it makes them upset? And so there's lots of psychological things you can play with too.
Yes.
Yeah, it makes sense. I do very much like the shapeshifters that, like, embody something that, like, the hero has like preconceived notions about, and then they find out that it's different from what they thought. Like, this is like literally like, oh, what the, like the point of like Shrek, like his whole deal is like people judge him before they get to know him, and he does the same thing to Fiona, and they literally have like that point in the story where like he tells her like, oh, you're not what I expected, and she's like, maybe you shouldn't judge people before you get to know them, and it's just like, yeah, yep. Right there you go.
Shrek is just an excellent movie.
Yes.
The other thing that you should make sure is to not make your shapeshifter more interesting than your hero.
Ooh, yes. That is so hard. That is so hard. That is near impossible. How do you even do that, Kristen?
Right.
All right, tell like, us your secret.
Are so interesting. Like, you just have to make your hero that interesting as well, you know? Like, don't give us a Mary Sue who keeps falling in love with an interesting character, you know?
Totally understand the thing where you should, like, I know there's, like, a piece of writing advice that's kind of like, if you have an idea for a story, you should pick the most interesting character to focus on. Like, if you have a lot of characters, you should pick the most interesting one. I don't think that always works, because sometimes a character's purpose is to be mysterious. And a character that is mysterious is frequently innately more interesting than a character that is not as mysterious. So you end up like with kind of a non-starter here, because you can't make the mysterious character your main focus, but like your character that is like your regular main character is probably not going to be like as interesting as your mysterious character. It's similar with like characters who go on like redemption arcs and things like that. It's like, I'm thinking about Avatar The Last Airbender again, because part of me is always thinking about Avatar The Last Airbender. But it's like, Zuko is my favorite character. But would I have thought that in the first episode when he's just being angry, mostly bald boy, like, who's like out, who's on like a rage rampage, like to kidnap this kid? Like, no. Like, if you're starting with that, it's just sort of like, okay, what? But like, okay, Aang is not like not interesting. At least they didn't pick like a Mary Sue like nothing character for that character. But like, Zuko's story is still more interesting. But it would be difficult to write the story with Zuko as the main character. Anyway, that's my rant. If you can make your main character interesting, they should be interesting. Please do try to do that. But, yeah.
I mean, I think one way you can do it is, like, even if your shapeshifter side character is more interesting as a person than your hero, then, like, your hero's arc can be more interesting, and then the shapeshifter is part of that arc, you know?
Mm. Okay.
It's just, it gets really annoying when I'm stuck in the hero's head and there's this, like, very fascinating character off to the side that is not in there as much as there should be, you know?
Sorry, I'm probably gonna take this out, but I wanna throw out there how, like, I totally loved, like, Mist and Fury, and Feyre is kind of a non-character, but, like, I'm okay with it, because, like, the story with Reese is so interesting, but then later you very much find out, beyond a shadow of a doubt, when you're reading, like, Silver Flames, you find out that, like, Reese and Feyre kinda suck. Like, the only reason that we enjoyed that was because we were in Feyre's perspective, like... But, like, if you're in anyone else's perspective, it's just like, oh, God, you guys are...
Yes, that is accurate. Please keep that in.
Oh, my God, I don't want to. I don't want to be that mean of a person on the internet.
Oh, okay, fine. It is important. Like, can you reword it so it's, like, better? Because I think it's an important point to make, you know?
Gosh, okay, what, how?
Okay. There are some stories with shapeshifters, hot shapeshifters are the main characters.
Okay, so like, I would bring the counterpoint, as we kind of touched on in our Love Triangle episode, that sometimes your main character is more or less a camera meant to showcase hot. And that's why we're here, your main character is a Mary Sue. Like, she's Bella Swan. She maths hard and falls down good. Like, And we're okay with that. We're mostly okay with that. I will concede that Bella is kind of sometimes gets like dumb and annoying. Like I will make that concession. But like sometimes the point of your story is to showcase like, I don't know, a sexy romance and isn't to make your main character interesting.
Ooh, that's true. But then also sometimes I feel like you have the shapeshifter character and they're so interesting because they're mysterious, because you're making up all of these like interesting stories in your head about them. And like in reality, maybe the author doesn't even know. Like even if the author did know and put their own thoughts that intrigue them down on paper, it just wouldn't. It wouldn't be as interesting.
It's like the beauty is in the eye of the beholder kind of thing. It's like the interest is in the mind of the reader, I guess. But I don't think that quite makes sense. Listeners, please come up with a better phrase.
You could also go the route of like a Watson-Sherlock thing where all the stories are told from Watson's perspective, even though Sherlock is the more interesting character. Like, you can do that.
That's true. That
allows Sherlock to be more of an enigma. Like, and it makes the stories more. Yeah, okay, so that's something, is like you make the relatable character tell the story, so it gives like the audience an actual window that they can understand. Because if you're trying to write from the perspective of basically a hyper-intelligent mastermind character, you might be asking a lot of your readers to keep up with everything that is going on in that person's mind. Also, that person is much more difficult to write because you have to come up with basically all of the genius, hyper smart things that are going through their head. I know I've tried to do this and it's like, it's not a good idea. Like, unless you already are that smart, like, it's not, it's not gonna work. So, yeah, make your main character interesting, or at least not insufferably dull.
Not dumb. No dumb main characters.
Or if they're dumb, it's for a good reason.
It's for a good cause.
No dumb.
Okay, and that's our episode. Listeners, what do you think? Don't worry, you can trust us. Or can you? We want to know, how do you feel about Marvel Loki versus Myth Loki? Email us at totropeornottotrope@gmail.com and let us know. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another trope and back in a month with another archetype. Thanks for listening to Trope or Not to Trope, and happy writing.